Welcome to The Trust Show. I'm Lottie Edwards, and today I'm joined by Oliver Kenyon, Senior Director at RTW Investments, Manager of RTW Biotech Trust. Welcome, Ollie. To begin with, could you just tell us a bit more about yourself? I know you joined RTW fairly recently.
Thanks, Lottie, and great to be here with you. Yes, I joined RTW in March last year. That was after about a 15-year career on the sell side in investment banking. The majority of that time was spent at JP Morgan Cazenove here in London on their investment banking team. It's actually how I came to know RTW. RTW were my client back in 2019 when I worked on the IPO of RTW Biotech Opportunities. So when I was looking for a change and maybe to come onto the client side, it was an obvious choice for me.
So there are seven players in the Association of Investment Companies healthcare sector, three of which have a pure biotech focus. What's RTW's niche? What differentiates it from its peers?
Great question. And I think biotech's one of those sectors where it's very specialist. So it takes a lot to sort of unpick it all. Just taking a step back, who are RTW? We are a global life sciences investor. We invest in innovative medtech and biotech investments across the globe. We were established in 2009 by our CIO and founder, Rod Wong. RTW are actually his initials. We've grown since 2009 to just under $10 billion in assets under management by year end, of which RTW Bio, our listed fund, is $800 million. What sets us apart? We are what we call full life cycle investors. Basically means we can go anywhere and do anything in biotech and medtech. So it means we can go very early. We can find some interesting asset, some interesting molecule in a lab, a university. Maybe it's one that Big Pharma owns and is sort of neglected. We can build our own companies around that. We call that new company creation. We can fund those through early clinical trials. We can hopefully IPO them, continue to own in the public markets. So we do that whole private public spectrum. We've also recently added royalties on the end. So because we're so flexible in providing capital at any stage of a company's life, we've got this status that we think as being a preferred capital provider. What has allowed us to maintain our edge over all these years? I think the two foundations of what we do are, one, really understanding the science. Biotech, as your listeners will know, is a very risky area. For every 100 drugs that enter phase one clinical trials, only 8 to 10 get spat out at the other end and are actually commercialized for use with patients. So you've really got to understand the science. We do that very well. We've got an investment team of about 40 people, half of whom who have advanced scientific degrees. They're either doctors themselves or PhDs. That will always be the core of what we do, and we think we do that very well. But now there's this whole cohort of biotechs that have actually commercialized their own drugs and are selling them. They're generating revenue. So what you need now for this next cycle is very strong commercial forecasting capabilities. We've got that as well. We think that gives us quite a good edge.
You mentioned royalties. I was interested in hearing a bit more about how much of the portfolio is in royalties and how that works.
Yeah, so right now it's a small amount of RTW Bio. It's about 2-3%. Our long-term aspiration is about 5-15%, so you should expect that to grow. RTW Bio gets its exposure to royalties through a dedicated fund that RTW manages. RTW Bio invests on a fee-free basis, so shareholders don't pay double costs. The commitment to that fund is about $30 million. But that commitment is drawn down as we find suitable investments. It's about half deployed as at year end from the committed capital. But what do we actually do? Well, we effectively provide biotech companies with launch financing. So in return for an upfront payment, we get a quarterly slice of the revenues coming from their drugs generate sales. We never take any approval risk, so we always fund on approval. Our funding is always contingent on that. Why do we do it? It really leverages the competitive advantage we've got. We get very deep relationships with these biotech companies. They're long and very fruitful. We get under the hood of what's happening. And it means that if we underwrite the equity, for example, it's very easy for us then to take a view on providing a royalty on that same company's drug sales. So that sort of sourcing advantage is very critical to us. That's what we think about it. But what does it provide to RTW Bio? Well, two things, really. One, it provides a different quality of returns. We get these quarterly cash flows that are uncorrelated to broader equity markets. And number two, cash flows in biotech, and especially for RTW Bio, will help us fund our private investments through their various clinical trials. So it's a nice little pocket at the moment that you should expect to rise over time and just introduces something a bit different. Mm-hmm. That's probably another edge that we got on some other people.
So if we think back to the start of 2025, there was a lot of uncertainty around healthcare. You had a new Secretary of Health in the US, threatened pharmaceutical tariffs, questions over drug pricing. What political risks are we left with today?
Yeah, I think that's very astute. 2025 was the year of political policy, regulatory volatility. It's the thing that really defined the year. And I mean, fortunately, we think most of those policy risks are behind us. We bucket those risks into three main areas. Number one, tariffs. Number two, drug pricing. And number three, FDA, the regulator in the US. Tariff risk. Pharma actually escaped the so-called Liberation Day tariffs in April. But then later on, pharma was threatened with them. The way that big pharma could escape these tariffs was by making commitments to manufacture drugs onshore in the US. There was about $300 billion of those commitments made by big pharma, Pfizer, Roche, etc. That effectively allowed them to escape tariffs, and that topic has really been put to bed for now. So we think that's a little bit in the rearview mirror. The second bucket of risk was on drug pricing, so-called MFN or most favored nation pricing. That's the idea that the US pays this, the rest of the world pays this, and relatively we want them, or the US wants them, to be a bit closer together. How has that panned out? Well, the rest of the world has ended up paying slightly more for drugs. You see that the NHS has increased the spend that it will have on novel treatments. Actually, that's a good thing, we think, for patients here, because about 40% of innovative drugs that are approved aren't available on the NHS because of funding constraints. So if we increase the budget, more patients will get newer, more effective drugs. We think that's a good thing. On the US side, the way that drug prices were reduced in the US, we think Pfizer effectively laid that blueprint. They got coverage for their obesity treatments on Medicare. It's the first time that Medicare has carried obesity treatments. So it's opened up this huge new market to them. The quid pro quo was that was done at MFN, most favored nation pricing, very low pricing. So they've traded off in price, but in return, they've got access to this huge market. That we'll probably have to see how that shakes out over the coming months and years. But we think a positive resolution to drug pricing. The final question mark is on FDA, and that's one probably still where the jury is out. There's been this whole carousel of personnel changes through the year, people resigning, some people resigning and then rejoining a week later. It's been quite volatile. The good news is that the overall number of NME, new molecular entity approvals, basically new drugs that the FDA approves, that has remained in line with long-term averages. So despite all this personnel headwinds, there hasn't been a huge impact on drugs coming to market, which is a good thing. that remains the big question mark for us. We think it's a focus now for the US administration, so we hope to see a resolution to that soon. But I think what you saw is as those risks receded, that's when the market really started to roar. And it was only until the end of the third quarter, start of the fourth quarter, where you really started to see biotech outperform.
The narrative for the past few years seems to have been that healthcare has been pretty cheap. But following this rally in the second half of 2025, RTW shares up 80% since the end of April. Is that still the case, or have investors maybe missed the chance to buy in?
This is a question we actually get a lot, which is always quite fascinating, because biotech's one of those sectors which is really driven by sentiment. And just winding the clock back, we had 2021, 2, 3 and 4, where the XBI, which is the S&P Biotech Index, underperformed the S&P 500. It's never done that for more than 1 year consecutively in history. And then we had a block of 4 years of consecutive underperformance. We entered 2025 also underperforming with all those political headwinds that we talked about. Finally, we ended the year outperforming. I think the XBI outperformed about 19% the S&P 500. 1 year of outperformance does not unravel the whole four-year bear market that we've been through, number one. I'd also position biotech against the broader market. So you've got the S&P at all-time highs. The XBI for sure has rallied off the lows that we saw last year, but it's still materially below the peaks that we saw in 2021. So on a relative basis, still a lot of value. If you look at more traditional metrics, price to sales ratio still for the XBI, still below long-term averages. And there's this great statistic about the number of small and mid-cap biotechs, less than $10 billion market cap, who trade with a market cap less than the cash on their balance sheet. So they might have 100 of cash and they trade at a market cap of 50. There's about, I think, as at year end, about 32% of small mid-cap biotechs trade like that. It is off the peak, which was about 40, so it's coming down, but still way above the long-term average. So we think in terms of value, both on an absolute and relative basis, there's still a lot more to go. Our CIO, Rod, says that we're in the early innings of the recovery. We don't know whether he's talking cricket or baseball. We assume he's talking baseball because there's nine innings there. So whether we're in the second innings of it, we're still very early in the cycle. And as we look forward into what this next cycle might bring, we're of the view that biotech is growing up. So people often think of biotechs as very small, not revenue generating. It's people in white coats doing lab experiments. Of course, you do need those people to do those, but biotech now is so much more than that. You've got this cohort of companies that focused on new modalities a decade ago, cell therapy, gene therapy. They were the real pioneers of these. They are now bringing the first products to market based on those modalities, and they are starting to generate revenue. It's a company in our portfolio called Argenx. It's a $50 billion market cap. It announced its earnings a couple of weeks ago, $4.2 billion of earnings, growing at 90% year on year. That's one of a handful, Alnylam, UCB. There'll be many more of these biotechs that effectively turn into small pharma companies. We think we're in this golden age of innovation, and we're very excited for what the next cycle has.
You mentioned some specific holdings there. Could you talk about what other areas of innovation the portfolio accesses?
Absolutely. So we're pretty diversified both across modality, i.e. a way of treating things. So whether that's cell therapy, gene therapy, small molecules like pills, we're diversified along those areas. We're also diversified by disease area or therapeutic area, whether that's cardiometabolic, inflation and inflammation and immunology, neuropsych, etc., rare disease. We've got investments across the whole piece. I think looking back on 2025, maybe a different way of looking at it is across different disease areas. 2025 was a great year for commercial launches. So there's biotechs that are launching products and making revenue from them. Our largest exposure in RTW Bio is a company called PTC. It's about 12% of NAV as at the end of December, focused on rare disease. They launched a drug called Sephience, which is for a disease called PKU. Don't ask me to pronounce it because it's unpronounceable, but basically PKU is a disease where the body can't break down a certain amino acid. That amino acid then aggregates in the brain, and it causes quite profound intellectual and developmental disabilities. Sephience is a drug to address that. It had a stellar first quarter of sales, and we think that consensus is probably behind where we think it is. So got a lot of hope for that sales continue. Another one, Urogen, focused on types of bladder cancer. They launched a drug called Zusduri. Again, great sales. We also have a royalty on that one. So we get sort of two bites of the cherry. I think maybe focusing just away from commercial on what areas are interesting. Cardiometabolic, super interesting. We had a company called Akero, which was focused on MASH, also known as fatty liver disease. It's where accumulations of fat in the liver lead to cirrhosis. They have a treatment that actually looks like it can reverse cirrhosis. Novo Nordisk saw the potential of that. They bought that company last year for $5 billion. Sad to see it go, but we got a lot more left in the tank. Especially in our private assets in cardiometabolic, we've got these two really exciting obesity assets. So you'll be familiar with the current crop of treatments like Wegovy and Mounjaro. Their injectable treatments have gastrointestinal side effects, and a lot of the profile of the weight loss is lean muscle mass loss alongside fat loss. Still very effective, and it's a huge category in pharma. It's the biggest category in pharmaceutical history. Consensus sales are about $100 billion a year for obesity treatments. We're looking at what comes next. What's going to be the next crop of treatments? Our two private investments, Corcel and Kylera, are super well placed. I'll just focus on one of them, Corcel. They have the oral pill form of obesity treatment. So you can imagine that's an absolute game changer. There's some people who have a needle phobia, or they simply don't want to inject themselves. The injections are a lot more expensive than the pill form. And I think as you think about people staying on these treatments, I could well imagine maybe taking the injections for a couple of months. Would I want to spend the rest of my life on it? Perhaps not. But the oral pill form is something that one could take alongside vitamins at breakfast. Corcel has that pill. We just did a Series D financing for that with some really blue chip other investors. It's one of our new company creations that I mentioned right at the start. We find an interesting asset, build a company around it, finance it through clinical trials. We think that's well positioned for an IPO this year. So really excited there. And then maybe finally, something that was once fringe and has now become mainstream, in the neuropsych space. We got a couple of investments focused on psychedelics. Enormously effective treatment, it looks like, for things like treatment-resistant depression. Very hard to treat depression. It looks like these psilocybin, that's the psychedelic compound, psilocybin-based treatments show real promise there. And not only for depression, but, you know, new things like seizures. There's some good early data there. So we're really interested in that sector, but it's a golden age of innovation, and it's a very exciting time to be here.
We should also talk about M&A. The RTW portfolio was exposed to record levels in 2025. Is that something you expect to see continue into 2026?
Absolutely. And again, it tracked that year of policy uncertainty. For RTW Bio, M&A didn't really get going until after the summer. That's when we saw tariff risks behind us, drug pricing risks start to resolve itself, and let's say a quieter time at the FDA. After summer, RTW Bio had five takeouts in its portfolio. Four of those were public, one of them was private, all done at quite healthy premium, just showed the market coming to life. 2025 was the best year since the pandemic in terms of deal volume across the market for M&A, about $120 billion of M&A done. It was actually the best year in at least the last decade, probably ever, in volume of deals above $1 billion. So, you know, really positive to see. The bigger deals that we saw were later stage and commercial assets. That kind of makes sense with all the political volatility. If you're a big pharma company buying a biotech, you want to de-risk it as much as possible with all these political headwinds. Later in the year, we saw more developmental stage deals happening. We benefited from one of those. We had a company called Avidity, focused on severe types of muscular dystrophy. That was taken out by Novartis for $12 billion, largest developmental stage deal of last year. 2026, we think, could be an equally good, if not better, year for M&A. That's due to the whole engine of what drives M&A is this idea of the patent cliff, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You get a limited amount of patent protection on drugs. Big pharma companies have effectively a monopoly for a certain number of years, after which their patent protection expires and those profits are competed away. The way farmers reload their pipeline is by buying small and mid-cap biotechs that have these innovative drugs. Two interesting things. Yeah. All farmers at some stage will have a problem with patent cliffs. It's a question of timing and it's a question of size. Some farmers will have them further in the future. Some will have them closer. Some will be smaller. Some will be bigger. If you look at something like Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, who have these great riches coming from their obesity treatments, tens of billions of dollars a year, they are really well placed to capitalize on this wave of M&A and buy more companies with all these revenues coming through, position of strength. You've got companies like Merck, which has a drug called Keytruda that will go off patent in 2028. And that's about half of Merck's revenue that will evaporate. Pretty severe problem that has to be fixed in the next couple of years. So we think as those patent cliffs come closer for everybody, you'll see more activity happen.
Could we talk about the trust discount as well? Last time I checked, it was around 11%, which has tightened quite a lot from lows of below 30 at points last year. So what kind of policy do you have in place to manage that?
Well, clearly, number one, I was hired in March last year. So as much as I'd love to take credit for all of the discount coming in, we have been helped with some secular factors. But what have we done? You know, for me, making the discount come in or encouraging it to come in is about stimulating the marginal buyer. And especially in these markets, retail is the key marginal buyer. So we've done a lot on our disclosure front. We've simplified our portfolio disclosure to make it easier for investors to see what we're doing. We've enhanced our disclosure on our private assets. You know, we know there's question marks around the market of companies that have private exposure. We have about 30% of our portfolio in private assets. So we think it's really important to show how confident we are with those valuations. We split it out on a vintage approach. And we're, you know, I say to everybody, we're very keen, whatever they would like to know, we will tell them because we're very confident about that portfolio. So a bit on disclosure. We've really ramped up our public relations exercises. We use Cadan Capital, who have been absolutely marvelous in getting us placements in both the national press and in more trade specific press. So that's really enhanced our reach, especially to retail investors. As I mentioned, we did our first retail webinar in November last year, directly speaking to our retail shareholders. So all that's been really helpful. Those secular things that helped us as well. The FTSE indices changed their rules at the start of last year to enable companies with non-sterling quotes to be included in the FTSE indices. We were admitted to the FTSE All Share and then the FTSE 250. Then we had a lot of index tracking demand come in. So that was very helpful. We did a few buybacks as well. And overall, we were just helped by the positive sentiment coming back into the market. So as you say, we're at around a 10% discount now. We'd love to see that come in further. And we'd really like to grow RTW Bio. We know that we need to scale it to continue to be relevant to our shareholders, especially wealth managers who need scale and liquidity. One way we can scale RTW Bio is through M&A. And we actually did that very successfully in 2024 with the acquisition of Arix Bioscience. We'd love to do something similar again with our shares at a 10% discount. It makes a deal more doable. So that's something that we're really focused on for this year.
I was at a conference the other day listening to a more generalist healthcare manager talking about the dramatic effect that artificial intelligence is going to have. He was talking about robot surgeons, and I specifically remember he was talking about an app that's going to be able to text you and say, you're having a heart attack, that sort of thing. But how big of an effect do you think AI is going to have at the biotech end of things?
Yeah, this is one of those mega trends that's getting a lot of attention as well. I think we see the immediate impact of AI more on the medtech side rather than the biotech side. So medtech, medical technology, that's devices and diagnostics. If you think about what AI and LLMs are at the moment, it's basically pattern recognition. So we have a company in our portfolio called RadNet. They're the largest imaging chain scans in the US. They've deployed AI screening tools for radiologists that help them assess the scans that they're already doing. That's already in place. That's commercial. That will accelerate revenue growth, improve margins, enhance the moat of RadNet. We see that as the very immediate application of AI. In terms of maybe biotech, you know, in drug development, we think that AI will probably increase the productivity of drug discovery. Possibly similar to the impact of sequencing the human genome. Therefore, it will shorten drug development times and hopefully get products to market faster. I think where there's a big question mark is AI in drug discovery, discovering new compounds. That's something that personally I don't see happening in the near term. I was reading one article the other day actually about the failure of AI in drug discovery. And then often in these articles, the most interesting things are below the line in the comments. And one of the comments said, but AI will help us think outside the box in drug discovery. Then one of the replies to that comment was, we don't even know what's in the box. And that, I think, is absolutely spot on. There's only so far we can go with AI before ultimately you have to meet the need to do a human clinical trial. That's the reason we do these things, because we can't forecast what happens when you put a compound in the human body. So that will always be the natural sort of endpoint of it. And until AI can solve that, that's probably a bit more of a longer term.
And just to finish with, we've mainly been talking about the US so far, but the trust has exposure globally. I'm particularly interested to hear, do you have any holdings in China or emerging markets?
China, yes. EM, less so. China is an extremely important market for biotech and healthcare investing in general. Just winding it back to what we think our niche is, we've been in China for the last half dozen years. We've had people on the ground there. Corcel, that obesity company I mentioned, licenses a Chinese asset. We have a team of people on the ground in China. We think to be a credible investor in biotech globally, you need China exposure. Why is that? Well, China's number two behind the US now in biotech innovation. In terms of clinical trial starts over the last few years, it's second to innovation, patent grants, etc. It's actually ahead of the US in some particular areas. Why is that? Well, you've had this real shift in China where the trade used to be commercializing Western medicine in China. But over the last few years, innovation has really ramped up. You've got a great ecosystem within China developing, whether that's West Chinese scientists who have trained in Western pharma or Western biotechs or even Western regulators going back to China and starting their own companies. China obviously is a huge country. It means you can do clinical trials. You can recruit patients faster. There's more of them, especially in rare disease. You can recruit them faster. It's cheaper. It's more efficient. Clinical trials cost an absolute ton of money to do. So the days and weeks you can shave off these, whether it's patient enrollment or running the trial, is really additive. So China is something that you need to have exposure to. China is good in some areas, not all areas. The US remains the global leader, but we see China as a great source of innovation for us. Corcel, I mentioned, a couple of other investments we've got. We've out-licensed those Chinese drugs multiple times. We're one of the most active venture capital firms doing that. We see it as a source of innovation and something that can be complementary to what we have.
Right, well, thanks for coming in, Ollie. I look forward to hearing more from RTW this year.
Thank you, Lottie. And actually, before you go, I should give you this book, which is Rod and the RTW Institute have written a book called Innovation is the Best Medicine, which is about policy in biotech. I'm afraid it's not signed, but happy reading.
Thank you very much.